Dear members of the European Society, today we have the great honor and pleasure to welcome Mr. Jamie Shi, who, as you all know, is the official spokesman for NATO. I'm very happy to see that so many of you showed up today. And of course, I'm very grateful to our friends at the Socialist Workers' Party for advertising this event. It's been of great help. I will first give the words to Professor Mary Kelder, who is the director of this at the Center of Global Governance here at the LSE, and who has done substantive research on regional wars and ethnic conflicts. So she will introduce Jamie Shi's lecture and tell some more about his background. As usual, there'll be some time for questions and answers after the speech.
Well, thank you very much, Philippe. I was really pleased yesterday, actually, when you asked me to chair this meeting, because Jamie Shi is an old friend, even though for long periods we've been on opposite sides of the fence. Especially when I was told about the socialist workers, I thought I was exactly the right person to chair this meeting, because I know Jamie for a very, very long time, from when I was very active in the European peace movement. And we used to go to NATO to argue with them. And that's how I got to meet Jamie. And he was, what was really great was that he was always very open, very ready to talk to us, very ready to give us information. And so I thought those people who really want to criticize the bombing in Kosovo, well, Jamie's absolutely the right person to have here today, because he will tell us how it seemed from a NATO perspective, and he will listen to the arguments, and he will really help you develop your ideas and sharpen your arguments. And that's what I've always found so valuable. So he's been at NATO for a long time. He's been the spokesman. Everybody saw him on television. And I, for one, thought he did an absolutely valiant job of what was a completely impossible position of trying to reconcile all these different positions within NATO and still come out as spokesman, having to apologize for terrible mistakes, having to... I didn't envy him at all as I saw his hair go grayer and grayer, whiter and whiter every day on the television. So anyway, we're very lucky to have him. There's nobody who knows more about what happened during those weeks than Jamie, I would say.
Mary, thanks. You've really rewarded that free lunch that I bought you in Brussels last Friday by saying those things. But unfortunately, Mary, you forgot to mention the most important point. As a result of my endeavours in the Kosovo crisis, I was voted by Elle magazine as the sixth sexiest man of the summer last year. Yeah. I can assure you, my wife laughed much more than that. And she said that if they had had a photo of my body and not just of my head, I wouldn't have sort of come in the 6 billionth position. But anyway, sincerely, I'm delighted to be here, and the fact that this room is filled up shows that the LSE is by far one of the finest institutions for freedom of speech and for interest in the affairs of this world. So thank you for vindicating my faith in the LSE by cutting your lectures and your tutorials and coming here this afternoon. And I'm extremely honoured as a FFP, or formerly famous person, to be invited, because, as you know, the Kosovo conflict is almost 1 year old now. It's already rapidly receding into ancient history. And so I suppose it's not a bad idea that together today we should try to draw some of the lessons before they fade into the realm of abstract academic theory. I'm going to talk, and you'll see I've virtually got no notes. I'm going to do this off the top of my head, about... the media aspect in particular, because obviously that's what I'm most associated with, but also because I find it one of the more interesting political conclusions, particularly in the relation between democracies and the new wars of humanitarian intervention. But at the end, I'll revert to the more traditional strategic perspective and tell you what I believe the lessons are, and they're rather awesome lessons in terms of European defence cooperation and the development of a true European security identity in the EU and NATO. But let me talk a little bit first about the way I perceive this conflict. I've thought about it a lot since I had time on my hands, no longer can chain to CNN, either watching it or appearing on it. I've had time to reflect, and what I believe is that we are now, if you like, in the paradox of the just war. Wars are becoming more civilized, at least in terms of their rationale and their justification. But paradoxically, they're becoming much harder to actually fight and wage, particularly for democracies. And it's in this sort of paradox that the problems arise for an organization like NATO or a spokesman such as myself. Now, it's true, as you know today, that international conflicts have not disappeared from the scene. Regrettably not. But they get far less publicity because they take place in areas of the world, mainly Africa, which are less covered, and because democracies, unlike Sarajevo in 1914, are much less likely today to be involved in those international conflicts. That's probably a good thing, but it can also be a sign of neglect and indifference, which can be a bad thing. And paradoxically, therefore, democracies today are more likely to get involved in wars in which they have no fundamental interest than ever before, because the rights of peoples in international relations are now looming larger, magnified as they are by the CNN factor, than the rights of states. There is pressure, therefore, in terms of upholding a community of values which we all believe in. And as the sovereignty of states loses its importance in the international system, it becomes much less of an obstacle to action than it would have been 40 or 50 years ago. In other words, the more we believe less in the value of sovereignty to ourselves, the more willing we are, obviously, to believe less in the value of sovereignty to Milosevic or to Saddam Hussein or to other dictators around the world. And of course, this is also the fact that, unlike international conflicts, civilians are bearing the brunt of the casualties in these internal conflicts in which states are collapsing or are unable to maintain themselves. In the First World War, for example, only about 5% of the total casualties were civilians. By the Second World War, that had gone up to around 50%, but in conflicts, for example, in Bosnia or Kosovo, that figure can be as high as 90%. In other words, victimizing civilians is no longer an accidental byproduct of fighting. It becomes the main purpose of fighting. Displacing, victimizing civilians, ethnic cleansing, social re-engineering ethnically is what the conflicts are all about. And therefore, this sense of the abuse of human rights, for we who believe more and more in it, is a powerful incentive for states to get involved. So in other words, as Tony Blair would have put it, we are now dealing with wars which are fought for higher standards of civilization than 50 years ago. No longer for land, no longer for dynastic succession or the control of economic resources, but purely to uphold the rights of individuals, simply because we believe we all belong to a common world community. And the just war, therefore, the notion of the just war, has made a powerful comeback since the days of Aristotle or Thomas Aquinas. The problem, however, ladies and gentlemen, is that as the curve of moral justification goes ever higher, and the rhetoric, of course, the actual means for waging such conflicts, although they have improved immeasurably since the massive shelling of World War I or the carpet bombing of World War II or Vietnam, remain extremely imperfect. And there is therefore a gap between the end and the means. I discovered that, of course, when I saw the same editorialists who had been screaming at NATO to intervene in Bosnia or Kosovo to stop ethnic cleansing and accusing us of being a paper tiger or moral cowards because we hadn't done so, suddenly turned violently against what we were doing when suddenly intervention or military force was no longer an abstract and therefore acceptable notion, but was an imperfect, messy thing, which often kills some of the same people that you're trying to save. In other words, when they were confronted with the reality of that military force, even though it had been used exactly for the purpose which they had called legitimate. So there is, therefore, the traditional gap between ends and means. And I'd like to illustrate this, if I may, today, by looking in more detail at those four cardinal tenets of the just war and seeing how they played out in the Kosovo crisis. Now, the first one, as you know, is the notion of the last resort, so that you should intervene only when you have exhausted all other means. The second one is this notion of proportionality, that your means have got to be strictly proportionate to your end. The third one, of course, is this idea of discrimination, that you must discriminate between innocent civilians and guilty military or paramilitary forces. And then finally, the idea that the good that you procure by going to a war in the first place should outweigh the inevitable price, the inevitable damage that has to be done to get to that objective. Now, first of all, if you take the last resort, you know, it's almost axiomatic today that no democracy would ever start a conflict without explaining to the voters that the extreme and blunt use of force is justified because it's no longer the best option, but the only option, all diplomatic means having failed. And therefore, as you know, in Kosovo, we spent 1 year, almost to the day, trying to negotiate with Milosevic before ultimately Operation Allied Force was launched. And of course, the end of the Rambouillet talks, the collapse of the Rambouillet talks, was a powerful justification for declaring that diplomacy was no longer going to get us anywhere, and that the conflict had to be used mainly to reshuffle the political cards in the region and therefore allow a solution to be achieved by diplomats, which without force they could not achieve. Now, of course, this is all very well, isn't it? But from a military perspective, it's not particularly helpful. First of all, it means delay while you are negotiating, particularly with people who don't want to negotiate or, like Milosevic, see negotiation as a useful way of spinning things out and diverting attention while achieving military facts on the ground. It means, for example, in Kosovo, that because we intervened 1 year after the conflict started, we've inherited a situation of hatred and a spirit of vengeance because of the casualties over the last year, which was not there in March 1998. And which therefore makes the whole job of reconstruction and reconciliation much harder, of course, given all of the tragedies that virtually everybody there has experienced. The other difficulty with this concept is that you today increasingly can only justify an intervention on the basis of a coalition. It's almost axiomatic that no country, at least no Western democracy, will be involved single-handedly. There is safety in numbers. That's true, but there is also legitimacy in numbers. I mean, NATO had no UN Security Council resolution, as is well known, to intervene in Kosovo, although we tried very hard to get one. Don't forget that. It wasn't the NATO countries that didn't want to go to the UN. It was one country that didn't want to give us that resolution. We had much wider support, by the way, in the UN than just the 19 allies. But of course, one therefore powerful legal basis or justification was the fact that all of the other democracies in the alliance saw the situation the same way as we did. In many cases, their parliaments had to formally vote, like the German Bundestag, the use of force constitutionally. So there was, if not an international legitimation, a powerful internal legitimation through parliaments and public opinion, but also through the fact that we were doing this collectively. It's very difficult for 19 countries together, freely, to decide to do something aggressive or profoundly unjust. But this, of course, means that if you have a coalition, you have to compromise on your strategy. Napoleon once famously said, "Lord, if I have to fight, let it be against a coalition." Because he knew perfectly well that coalitions tend to be rather weak, they divide easily, they have trouble agreeing on objectives or strategy and tactics. And of course, in the NATO dimension, this led to two basic problems, which came back to haunt us. Number one is that we had to have a very transparent debate, because that's part of the legitimation, debating these issues transparently, in which it very soon transpired that the Allies, most of them, were not prepared to involve themselves in a ground attack, a ground option. They would only contemplate an air campaign. So although afterwards innumerable retired admirals or retired generals went on television to proclaim that, you know, a war had never been won from the air alone, or that only a ground attack would succeed, and if they were still the chief of the general staff, that's what they would be recommending to their politicians. Although we had that, the reality of the matter is we had a choice not between the perfect strategy and an imperfect strategy, but a choice between an imperfect strategy and nothing at all. Secondly, because of the transparency in which the coalition building takes place, Milosevic knew exactly what we were prepared to do and what we were not prepared to do. We ruled out that fundamental element of surprise. That meant that Milosevic was able, knowing that NATO was not planning a ground attack, to withdraw all of his forces that were up on the Macedonian border, where NATO had at the time 6,000 troops deployed, and break them up into small groups where they were free to get on with the ethnic cleansing. Which, of course, meant that the Albanians suffered the brunt of that. And secondarily, because they were broken up into small packets and were intermingled with the civilian population, NATO, from 15,000 feet, had a much harder job finding them and attacking them. It's much easier, as you well know, to focus on a unit deployed en masse in the field than it is to find a tank hiding in a farmhouse or in a haystack, or as we found out tragically with the Jackovica tractor convoy incident on April the 14th, where civilian and military vehicles were all mixed up on main roads. The third consequence, if I can add this way I think of it, is that by making our strategy so transparent, we also made it clear that we were not prepared to use overwhelming force immediately. In fact, we started out with 300 aircraft. And therefore, we committed ourselves to a strategy of gradual escalation in the hope that the minimum would work, but being prepared to sort of go up the ladder towards the maximum if we had to. Now, that would have people like Colin Powell turning in his grave, if he were there yet, which I'm glad for him he's not. Because, you know, he's always been associated in the United States with the doctrine of overwhelming force. The idea that you don't do that, because it conveys an impression that somehow on that chain of escalation, you're going to stop. You're going to say, uh-oh, that's enough. I'm not prepared to go any further. If I can't win with this amount of force, I'm not prepared to double it. And that, of course, gave Milosevic an incentive to sit it out, to see if NATO would lack the staying power that he believed he had, that it would become a contest of wills. And in a society like Yugoslavia, a man like Milosevic is able to absorb a large amount of damage, particularly by stoking up patriotism as well as keeping the population in line. And so clearly he had an interest, even if he was taking significant amounts of damage, to just wait to see how far NATO was prepared to push it. Clearly, if we'd have been able to show right in advance that we were prepared to push it very far, then Milosevic may have given in a lot earlier. But of course it's very difficult, and I say this with utter conviction, being the representative of an alliance of democracies, it's very difficult for democracies to commit themselves to overwhelming force on day one. Well, we are, after all, if I can use this expression, the good guys, who are very reluctant to use force, and who, obviously, if we have to use it, want to keep it strictly minimal, obviously. But it's not necessarily militarily logical to do it. In fact, one of my first lessons that I'm going to draw from our experience is that force is not really variable. This is rather depressing, but it's true. It can't really be sort of switched on off or moderated like the flow of a tap. We started with 300 planes and only bombing in daytime against strictly air defense targets in Kosovo and south of the 44th parallel. 2 months later, we had 1,300 aircraft, including the whole panoply of B-2s and C-130 Spectre gunships and B-52s. Yes, they're still very much around, as you know. We had extended the bombardment to the whole territory of Yugoslavia, including Belgrade and strategic targets. And we had started to draw up a ground invasion plan involving 200,000 troops. And we were literally within days of taking a decision to launch a ground attack on the 15th of September. So in other words, we discovered that for a very, very limited humanitarian intervention, which was not about getting rid of Milosevic, which was not about occupying Yugoslavia, we said we have no quarrel with the Serb people. We didn't even use the word war. You remember? We said conflict to imply that it was something more limited. Semantics, yes, but diplomacy, semantics are very important. We discovered, to our astonishment, that even a tiny little objective, the removal of Milosevic's troops, the return of the refugees, the introduction of an international peacekeeping force in an area which is not much larger than Kent and Sussex, that required the type of force that we would have considered for an Article 5 self-defense mission of NATO in the heyday of the Cold War. And this brings me to my second point about proportionality. One of the difficult dilemmas involved this concept. We naturally wanted to win by taking the conflict directly to the people who were carrying it out against the Kosovar Albanians. And the media obviously wanted that. Everybody wants that the innocent be spared, but those who are really guilty get their comeuppance or feel the brunt. And that meant, of course, concentrating on the fielded forces of the Yugoslavs in Kosovo itself, the guys who were pulling the triggers, the guys who were doing the ethnic cleansing. And, of course, every time General Clark, the sacker, came to the NATO Council, all of the ambassadors would say to him persistently and insistently, General Clark, it's all very well about these bridges in Belgrade or at Novi Sad, hundreds of kilometers away from the theater of operations in Kosovo, but what are you doing about the fielded forces? Diplomats were under pressure. We were under pressure from the media to show that we were concentrating on those who were, if you like, less able to claim protection. The problem is it's very difficult to attack those forces successfully, particularly from the air, because of the decoys, because on 50% of all of the days in the first 6 weeks of the campaign, we had such intense cloud cover that only the United States had the precision-guided weapons to operate, and only then by actually flying B-2 bombers all the way from Arkansas, 36 hours, to fire some missiles and then go straight back again. And I'll come back to this in later on when I draw the conclusions. And therefore, we had a choice between a kind of very proportionate series of attacks, strictly concentrating on the fielded forces in Kosovo, but with an extremely slow rate of attrition. And therefore, the air campaign going on until Christmas 2006, which in political public opinion terms would have been inconceivable, obviously, or a campaign to extend airstrikes disproportionately to the remainder of Yugoslavia by attacking bridges and fuel dumps and the command and control of the Yugoslav army. Knowing that this was riskier, obviously, and the Chinese embassy as well as other incidents in Belgrade proved that, but knowing that that was also the way to make it clear to the regime that they could not be sanctuarized from the effects of their actions, and of course to bring the reality of this confrontation directly home to the Yugoslav people. But and of course that strategy, which is the one we pursued, was successful, but it carried a price. But what would you do if you were in that situation? Which way would you go? A very low-key approach, but with the very small chance of success, or a much more intensive approach, more risky, more controversial, but at least means that you can make force work. And of course, once you cross the Rubicon to use force, and that is the decisive decision, you obviously have to make it work, and work as quickly as possible. What would have been the best for ultimately for the Yugoslav people, that sort of short campaign, strategic campaign, but mercifully short, or a much longer process of pinprick attrition? It's a dilemma. And we're going to have to think about that in the future much harder. The next point is discrimination. NATO dropped 23,400 missiles and bombs on Serbia, on Yugoslavia, during Operation Allied Force. Sounds a lot, doesn't it? But compared with Vietnam, where the US dropped more bombs than during the entirety of World War II, it's not. Now, 30 of those did not work, misdirected. And we had 13 incidents of something which is going to be printed on my tombstone, but I'll use it because you know what it means. It's a horrid term, but it identifies the problem, the so-called collateral damage. I didn't invent that, by the way, although to my sins I used it. Let's be clear about what that means. It means the accidental killing or harming of innocent civilians. Now, in statistical terms, that is extremely small. It's a fraction of 1%, and you could argue, and the military will do that, that this made it the most significantly accurate air campaign in human history. There were 13 instances where NATO bombs misdirected and hit civilian targets, and many civilians died. We don't have a number. Even the Yugoslavs come out with different figures all the time, but it was more significant than we would have hoped. Although I'm going to make a plea for context in just a few moments. But let's look at this. First of all, we had, during Operation Allied Force, over 50% of the missions overall which did not drop ordnance, because pilots came back saying we weren't certain of hitting the target, the cloud was such, the height was such, we didn't want to take the risk, therefore we didn't do it. In fact, one of the problems we had in NATO is that many of these missiles were dropped in the Adriatic because aircraft were coming back loaded more frequently than in any other air campaign in human history. And therefore, we dropped them in the Adriatic and had to go and clean them up afterwards. Several of them appeared in the fishing nets of Italian fishermen. So there were an enormous number of accidents which in World War II would have been entirely frequent, but which didn't happen. Secondly, we ran all of the targets on computers and spent days trying to work out the exact velocity of the missile, hitting which side of the building, at which angle, at which time of the day, when buildings, of course, would be unoccupied, like night, in order to minimise the prospect of blast damage to surrounding areas. Now, I know that this is a controversial topic, and I'm not trying to play down the significance of those 13 incidents. In fact, they're like a millstone round my neck for the rest of my life. I understand that fully. But if you go to Yugoslavia today, if you go to Kosovo, and many of you, I no doubt, have done this, I guarantee you that you will not find evidence of mass NATO bombardment. I said mass NATO bombardment. In certain key targets, like an oil refinery, yes, naturally. But this is not in any way comparable to the type of bombing that took place in World War II or in other conflicts. No. All right. Yeah, okay, I know you're going to give me all these questions. I know, you're going to give me all these questions in a minute. All right. No, but all right, and I'm going to answer. I know, I didn't come... Well, you can either listen to me or not. All right, I'm presenting, as I say, my view. That's the first point. In other words, although, naturally, we had these incidents, I want just to stress that we did make inordinate efforts, not always successful, but we made inordinate efforts to try to avoid this altogether. Now, if any of you have got the formula for the accident-free military intervention, please give it to me at the end of today's session. But there is, and I'm going to return to the point about how we could try to avoid this in future, but avoidance carries a heavy price as well. Secondly, it's a good thing today that we attach so much importance to human life. It's a good thing that the loss of human life, even in a conflict, even because of a foul-up, becomes a scandal. In other words, because the technology is getting better and better all the time, at least for those who are willing to make the investments, these type of things are becoming the exception rather than the norm. In World War II, in World War I, they were the norm rather than the exception. And people didn't raise a protest. I mean, how many people in this country, raised immense protests when Dresden was bombed in February 1945, for instance, or Cologne was firebombed? There were some. But what I'm saying is that, and I'm used to be a military historian of sorts myself, compared with earlier wars, where there was a sense of, you know, the demonization of the enemy, even the common citizens of the enemy. And I've studied this in depth. We are now in a situation, and this is a good sign of civilization, where we don't do this any longer. We make differences between the regime and innocent people. That's absolutely obvious. That's good. But we don't confuse the Serb people, of course not the Kosovo Albanians, with somebody like Milosevic. But this poses a dilemma for a democracy. Because if we make the perfect the enemy of the good, if we say that unless the military campaign is going to be absolutely 100% perfect, and we're not going to have any incidents like this at all. Otherwise, it becomes wrong. It becomes a war crime or whatever. And that this has to lead to perfect outcomes. I can guarantee you that no democracy will ever send any military force again. If every pilot who makes that type of mistake is immediately arraigned before a war crimes tribunal, you won't get any pilots. And therefore, you will simply have a policy of self-paralysis. Would that be what we want to see? I don't believe so, quite frankly. The lesson, of course, is that we can do better. The technology of modern munitions has allowed us to achieve levels of discrimination, levels of accuracy, which would have been unthinkable. And it's because you believe in the perfection, perhaps, of these munitions, that you are scandalized when it goes wrong. The higher the expectations, the more the very rare exceptions appear to be totally unacceptable. That's obvious. Well, then the answer is clear. We have to invest lots of money, more than we invested perhaps even during the Cold War, in perfecting these systems. And the problem is that most countries in NATO, including this country, simply do not have these capabilities. We have a lot of aircraft in NATO participating in this mission that did not drop any ordnance whatever, were simply there for protection purposes because they simply had the old dumb bombs. Or they didn't have laser guidance or night vision equipment. And so they were next to useless in a war of humanitarian intervention, where this type of key discrimination is an important factor, not only in legitimacy, but in public support, and therefore in the difference between success and failure. But are you really willing to see your defense budgets go up enormously? for this type of R&D and procurement to take place, to give us those kind of more sophisticated and discriminatory capabilities. I think this is a key challenge that democracies have to face if these humanitarian interventions are going to really be the flavour of the future. Now let me come to the fourth point about the just war, which is the one about the end has to justify the means. Now, of course, this is a difficult one, isn't it? We can argue, and I would, that NATO succeeded in meeting its objectives in Kosovo as we define them, which were, of course, the removal of Milosevic's forces, the introduction of a NATO peacekeeping force, and the return of the refugees. But most people are not willing to grant us that success for the simple reason that the goalposts have changed, haven't they? We now define success in Kosovo as being the creation of a stable multi-ethnic society based on reconciliation. And we know that if that objective can be achieved, it's going to take several years. So, as the American president Andrew Jackson said in the 19th century, the value of all conflicts resides in the peace that they help to create, and there the jury is still going to be out, probably for many years yet, before post facto Operation Allied Force will be truly deemed to have been justified. So we have to accept that, and I accept that in the alliance. But I think more importantly, where you talk about the end justifies the means, I think we have to recognize one cardinal fact, and this struck me with the media, which is that conflicts have to make things worse before they can get better. This is very difficult to accept, isn't it? When a conflict doesn't produce a solution immediately, it takes 78 days. And at the time, what you are seeing on your TV, are things going terribly wrong. I mean, if you were... as you all were, no doubt, viewers of the BBC or CNN or any other channel during those 78 days, you would have probably thought, what the heck is going on here? You know, NATO started an air campaign, and as a result, Milosevic has suddenly deported hundreds of thousands of Albanians. In other words, as many journalists said to me, you have turned a humanitarian problem into a humanitarian catastrophe. You know, if you hadn't started this... you know, none of this would have happened. Well, again, this strikes me as rather perverse, frankly. First of all, because I think now we have plenty of evidence from the OSCE reports and the UN reports and others that Milosevic had planned and systematically begun to execute this campaign well before NATO intervened. It's called Operation Horseshoe, albeit Milosevic accelerated it once NATO had started bombing. But, I mean, you know, if you introduce police into a city and the crime rate goes up as a reaction, what do you do? Sort of take the police away? Is that the solution? So clearly, if anything, I don't think that the ethnic cleansing of Milosevic undermined the basis for what NATO was doing. I thought no refugee ever went into Albania or Macedonia and said, I left because NATO started bombing. They all said, I left because Serbs came at 6 o'clock this morning, took my money and my passport away and told me to leave. So I think it exemplified the reasons why NATO had to act. But I agree that the perception at the time is that we had made a situation worse. But ladies and gentlemen, conflicts are based, even humanitarian ones, on that notion that sometimes the you've been responding to violence with violence. You have to accept a temporary worsening of the situation in order to get to a solution, or painful as it is at the time. It's like if you have an ulcer and you go to see your doctor, and the doctor says, sure, I can cure your ulcer, but I can only do it by opening you up, taking your entrails out and you know, draining a bit of blood and so on, and I'll stitch you up afterwards. It's not going to be very pleasant, but at least your ulcer will be cured and you'll start getting better. But that is a price we have to pay. And now, of course, the impression on CNN at the time was that things were not going well. We had the so-called collateral damage incidents. We had the refugees. We had Milosevic defiant. The problem for somebody like me in managing the media is that the good news only occurs in the last day. In other words, it's like a football match where you're only going to score a goal in extra time and not before. Because all conflicts are judged retroactively, aren't they? It depends on who wins and under what circumstances, whether that conflict was a good one or a bad one. So it's very difficult to have a judgment at the time moving forward. I mean, if you'd watched CNN, I bet all of you would have drawn a conclusion that NATO was not winning and was not going to win. Because NATO had not won on Tuesday, it would not prevail on Wednesday. Now, the problem is here is what is important is not news, not always. And what is news is not always important. The Jakovica convoy incident, we all remember that. 5 days, CNN, hour after hour after hour. Why? Because TV had a picture of that. That was why. And because it was a dramatic picture, and because TV builds a story around a picture. Now, TV doesn't start with, you know, what's important, and let's find some pictures to illustrate it. It starts with, well, what pictures we've been able to get, and let's build a story from that. But the consequence for NATO is no pictures, no news. Many times when the Jacovica tractor convoy was playing for the umpteenth time on CNN, making NATO look extremely bad, obviously, I desperately wanted to be able to show some pictures of the deportations or of people being cleaned out of their houses or whatever by Milosevic's security forces. And I begged the military in NATO, I begged the Pentagon to provide me with those pictures and some of that photographic evidence. Not because I was trying to deny that Jacovica occurred, it did occur, but because in conflicts, context is vital. You know, NATO drops a bomb on a tractor convoy, NATO is terrible, yes. But if you start to ask yourself, well, why was NATO there in the first place? Why was the pilot there at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and not in a base in North Carolina somewhere? You know, why had NATO started this campaign? Because of. Then obviously things are relativized very quickly indeed. They're not forgiven, but at least they can be better explained. For example, during the 5 days while the Jacovica tractor convoy was the one dominant story, Milosevic evicted 250,000 Kosovo Albanians from their homes. I phoned up a BBC executive on this and complained, you know, why the heck aren't you showing this side of the story? Where's the balance here? And he said, oh, Jamie, it's easy. Refugees, we did that last week. We did that last week. In other words, it's not news. What is news is something that's not expected. But, you know, that's not necessarily what determines the outcome of history, ladies and gentlemen. It's like the old story, you know, if a dog bites a postman, and that happens about a million times a year, in the UK, it doesn't get any coverage, whereas if the postman in a fit of retaliation bites the dog, it gets somewhere. Now, a postman biting a dog is statistically irrelevant, but it's news. Genuinely, I think one of the reasons why the Chinese embassy bombing got the coverage it did, I mean, obviously it was significant, although it didn't have any bearing on the outcome of the war, none at all, but one of the reasons why it was covered was because nobody expected NATO would be so stupid as to actually do that. You know, journalists phone me up saying, my God, we never believed you'd do this. This is spectacular. Although, again, regarding the outcome of the conflict, irrelevant. Now, let me ask you to do something. I imagine all of you, occasionally on a Sunday afternoon, take your cars, if you have them, and drive from A to B to visit your granny and have tea. And you see the landscape from A to B. And then suddenly, you know, after your tea with your grannies, you get back in the car and drive from B back to A. You take exactly the same route, you know, that same number of miles, same scenery. But I guarantee you, when you go from B to A, you have an utterly different perspective on it than if you go from A to B. It's almost as if it's a completely new journey and not simply a repetition of the old one. Now, similarly, if you're a historian today, looking at the Kosovo conflict, why did NATO win? And I use the term win without any humility. Why did NATO win? Well, we'd argue because it stayed together, because it showed a willingness to escalate, because it conducted secret diplomacy with the Russians, because Milosevic was very depressed in his bunker and was being advised not to pursue this any longer. In other words, everything that CNN did not show at the time. It's like an iceberg. You know, I don't blame CNN. I mean, you can only film what you can see. You can't film the invisible. And so CNN filmed that part of the iceberg that it came above the surface. But it was the least important in determining the conflict resolution factors that now, obviously, historians will play on. So at the time, yes, you know, you would have seen the story was the news. But the news isn't necessarily what ultimately is important. Everything is a question of perspective. But as I said, the problem for a spokesman like me is that perspective is difficult to put in at the time. It comes afterwards. So, ladies and gentlemen, where am I coming out on all of this? Well, I think, obviously, the Kosovo conflict proves one thing, that no matter how good we think in NATO we were in launching this operation, no matter how much we felt that we were doing the right thing, I think we've learned that public opinion doesn't necessarily agree, or not instantaneously. In other words, a just war has to be sold, in a way, probably even more than an unjust war, quite frankly. Public opinion is very fickle. and the press are too, they tend to believe in the cause but expect a perfect implementation. And we can't guarantee that. Even if we spent billions of dollars more on defence, we still couldn't guarantee perfection. And secondly, public opinion tends to feel that an objective is no longer worthwhile if the price is more than zero casualty warfare, which applies on both sides nowadays, not only to our own pilots, but obviously to civilians on the other side as well. As the Americans found out in Somalia back in 1993, you know, you may launch an operation for all the right reasons with a militarily effective force. You may be tackling the real problems. You may be getting somewhere. For example, that operation at least helped to distribute food supplies in Somalia. But you lose 18 Rangers in a shootout one Sunday morning, and public opinion goes from cheering to shouting and screaming, and you have to stop that operation immediately. Has it lost its strategic value? No. Have you stopped doing the right thing? No. But 18 people suddenly becomes a great stigma of failure. So one of the reasons I think why politicians and spokesmen like me have to work so hard is because public opinion is fickle. I mean, every time we had an instance where a NATO bomb struck the wrong target, we had to witness a 30% fall in public support in Germany, for instance, a country that I watched quite closely. And it took us a long time to build that back up again. I think another thing is we're going to have to think far harder about how we influence the public opinion of an adversary. I mean, Milosevic had a great advantage over us in that he was able to take Western journalists in a bus from Belgrade to the site of a NATO accident, film obviously the very harrowing scenes, and get those journalists seconds later to put those images on Western television, where naturally they had an extremely disturbing impact on Western public opinion. I'm not blaming journalists. They were doing their job. And those incidents, even if Milosevic may have played them up, obviously he did, it was in his interest to do so, were real. They did happen. They weren't simply fabrications. But of course, those Western journalists were not allowed, obviously, to film burning buildings, deportees on roads, or interview Albanians en route to Jacovica or anywhere else. And one key problem that we have, apart from generating more photographic evidence, more pictures to show our side of the story on the assumption that words are not believed but pictures are instantaneously seen as incontrovertible evidence, one lesson of course there is that we have to work harder and use some of our incredible technological resources like satellites and drones to gather precisely that evidence. Although there is a problem, I asked a lot for photographs of mass graves because we had evidence of those. But I was told that in order to have information sent to the International War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague so that Carla Del Ponte and Louise Arbour could make use of it to indict Milosevic, it had to be kept secret. You see, the trouble is if, you know, I immediately put up all these pictures in my NATO press conferences every day, although it would have helped me at the time to show that, yes, you know, we've done this, but don't forget what Milosevic is deliberately doing. I mean, you know, we're setting out to save civilians, even though we can't guarantee it, but Milosevic doesn't have that objective. It's the opposite. The problem is that we would have told Milosevic what we knew, and he would have then, as he did, sent his bulldozers the next day to the mass grave to clear out all of the corpses and burn them, or throw them in the rivers or whatever, and so that afterwards the War Crimes Tribunal would have lacked forensic evidence for prosecutions and further indictments. So there's a difficult choice to be made here. But in the main, we need to get the message to our adversaries, public opinion. And there it was impossible. The BBC interviewed Milosevic's spokesman ad nauseum, more than he even interviewed me, by the way. But I was never able to appear on Serb TV or even give interviews to any of the Yugoslav media. I think in future we have to see about setting up radio stations and using anything we can. Maybe we should have done more in Montenegro, for instance, with the newspapers there, to get our message across to Serbs, who even today remain largely in ignorance about what really happened in Kosovo. Well, okay. Well, ma'am, I don't expect you to agree with me everything I say, but I've come to make my view, and you're going to get your chance to ask a question in exactly 2.5 minutes. So may I suggest you let me finish. We use the internet, which, of course, is a great medium for getting round repressive governments, as it is in other areas of the world. But there, interestingly enough, the Yugoslavs had a highly successful ping attack on our website and on our email system, which put them out of action for the best part of 2 weeks in what is probably one of the first illustrations of cyber warfare. But I think we need to think about that a lot. Now, finally, a few of the strategic implications of this. Well, I think the first point that we have to recognize is that public opinion today and the media are placing incredibly demanding constraints, which ironically they don't seem to put on our adversary. Almost this, because we claim great objectives, we are held to account rigorously, and every failing becomes a major scandal. But the media tend to sort of expect Milosevic to act in a less civilized way, and therefore he doesn't seem to be so criticized when he does. Now, I think there is a difference of standards here, but then again, I think if that shows the difference between a democracy and another form of regime, I'm not going to complain about that. But therefore, if we accept the logic, you know, of perfect operations, then obviously we're going to have to start spending billions of dollars. The problem is that in Operation Allied Force, the United States provided 67% of the aircraft. It provided 81% of all of the strike missions. It provided 93% of all of the cruise missiles. And when we destroyed the Chinese embassy, which was a major mistake, we also learned that it cost $4 million to destroy the Chinese embassy accurately. Four cruise missiles were used, each costing $1 million. Now, unlike World War I, you are therefore spending 20 times more money to destroy a building today accurately than you are to rebuild it. In other words, in the age of humanitarian operations, because of the restraints, destruction, ironically, becomes more expensive than reconstruction. UK had 13 cruise missiles, which it all used, but no other country has that type of capability in Europe at the moment, although France is developing it. The United States selected all but one of 1,400 strategic targets. Virtually all of the intelligence came from that source. And you don't be surprised if the US had such a big influence on the operation, giving that preponderance of capabilities. What we find in Europe at the moment is that the European allies spend about $146 billion a year on defense, which is about 60% of the US total and about 20% of the global total. So, you know, Europe spends a lot of money, but only has 10% of the projection capability of the United States, because much of that money goes into things that you can't really use. The Dutch army, for example, although the Netherlands has 14 million people, has 480 tanks, but you can't use tanks to stop refugees. Well, you can't use tanks, of course, in a situation where you're doing peacekeeping in Kosovo or Bosnia today. Others are spending on barracks or infrastructure or whatever. And therefore, in the future, as I mentioned, European politicians will have a straight choice. They'll either spend this money and get the type of projection which will allow them, for example, to do preventive diplomacy, to send a force in advance of a conflict breaking out, as the UN did successfully in Macedonia with UNPREDEP, or at least to go in afterwards and secure a situation like we have done in Bosnia and Kosovo. But at the moment, of 2.2 million troops under arms in Europe, we can only deploy, Europe, 2% of that total. The rest are paper soldiers. One half is training to be soldiers, and the other half are training them to be soldiers. Doesn't leave very many for actually deployment overseas. The United States today spends more than 20% of its defense budget on trying to perfect its weaponry. I'm not arguing that it's going to be perfect, of course not, but at least it's making the effort to get away from the old dumb bombs of the past. That is today $36 billion a year on R&D and $60 billion overall for procurement. The Europeans together are spending $9.8 billion. Some countries, like Belgium, where I live, are spending less than 6% of their defense budget today on R&D. So, you know, whatever you feel about weapons, I mean, at least in Europe, we're stuck with the most unusable type, unless we're fighting for national survival once again, and nobody will object to carpet bombing because there's a feeling that that's the price that has to be paid for national survival, a la World War II. But we're not talking about that, and everybody knows. Let me give you another example, intelligence. During the Cold War, intelligence had a shelf life of about 4 or 5 days. You know, if you photographed a Soviet division on Monday, you could be pretty certain that on Friday it was still there. You didn't need to update the intelligence. Now, take a situation like Kosovo. Imagine an example where you have a drone that goes over a building on Monday and sees a MUP unit of the Yugoslav Special Police in that building. And then on Tuesday, without updating the intelligence, gives a pilot the order to attack it as a legitimate military target. Imagine that in the meantime, the Yugoslav MUP forces have moved out, and a number of refugees have gone there because of bad conditions to sleep for the night. In other words, because your intelligence was not updated immediately, you turn what could have been a successful and justified military strike into a complete catastrophe, which could derail your entire operation. That's because you don't have the intelligence. But Europe doesn't have the intelligence, I can guarantee you, to come even remotely near that type of accuracy. Let's take cyber conflicts. One thing that's in the news at the moment is the idea, well, you know, if weapons, unfortunately, are going to kill people, even for the best of motives, then let's try to sort of solve these conflicts without recourse to weapons. And some are interested in, you know, logic bombs and computer viruses and hacking in order to win by society or the military machine or even the economy of a potential adversary dysfunctional. But again, is that really the solution? What happens, for example, if you shut down the Belgrade electricity supply and as a result incubators in hospitals are put out of action and babies die? That doesn't use a bomb, but it could be potentially far more destructive, both short-term and long-term, than a bomb. Therefore, you know, what are the consequences of international law? And of course, if we let the genie out of the bottle by making, you know, giving the idea that, you know, computer hacking is somehow legitimate, then obviously, you know, people will start using it against us as well, and we could get into a sort of a jungle, which would be bad given the critical dependence of globalization upon advanced information technologies. But what I'm trying to say is that I believe, and I believe very, very strongly, that these interventions should take place. Because I believe that it's very easy to criticize what NATO did without looking at all of the things that might have happened in Kosovo. Where would it be today? Where would the region be today? How many more people would have died in the long run had NATO not acted? In other words, if there are two sins, the sin of omission and the sin of commission, then I suppose at the end of the day, I always will come down on the side of the sin of commission. But on the other hand, I do believe, drawing the lessons of Kosovo, that there is an obligation on behalf of the Western democracies to do whatever they can, first to try to prevent having to go to war through exhausting all diplomatic means, to look far, far harder at what we can do with preventive diplomacy, particularly preventive deployments, which have only been used once in the whole history of the United Nations. Thirdly, to do whatever we can to perfect the military technology, so that even if we can never have an accident-free war, we can at least continue the trend, which despite Kosovo I can see as a good trend, towards being able increasingly to save civilians and discriminate effectively between civilian and military targets. But ultimately, most importantly of all, we have to see whatever we can do in terms of resources today in Kosovo with constant pressure, constant patience, to build the kind of multi-ethnic society which is our vision, because only that way can we ultimately justify what we did. But of course the problem is, as General Reinhardt, the NATO commander, pointed out just the other day in an interview to a German newspaper, the United Nations mission in Kosovo under Bernard Kouchner has not been able to find $136 million so far to finance its annual budget, which represents half a day of NATO bombing. In other words, we have not found the infinitely smaller resources which would turn peace as the absence of war in Kosovo today to real peace and really vindicate what NATO did. We have a Kosovo Liberation Army which is being successfully disarmed, demilitarized, but without... Yes. Oh, no, it is. It is. It is. Well, I don't know. You obviously go to Kosovo every day and know much more about the situation than I do. But we have not found... the money yet to pay the salaries of the people we're now trying to convert to civilian functions. Equally, we have a terrible law and order situation because we have not found the resources to establish a system of judges or a system of a law and order, which will mean that those guilty of crimes are not only found but actually are put on trial rather than being released back into the society. So I think, again, the conclusion that I would draw is that we mustn't believe that because Kosovo no longer is on the front pages of the newspapers, that the hardest part of the job, but also the most relevant part of the job, is still before us. Anyway, I thank you for being a very patient audience.
I'll transfer to the question.
Well, thank you very much, Jamie, for giving us in your usual fluent way an account of the NATO intervention. I thought before I would open the floor to questions that I would abuse my position as chair by asking a question myself. And when you were describing to us very vividly the problems of military force and the limitations, there was one limitation you didn't refer to, which is the problem of carrying out a humanitarian intervention when you are not prepared to risk casualties on your own side. If you take the position that human beings everywhere are equal and that you're intervening to protect human beings, isn't there a problem when Western lives are privileged over the lives that you are supposed to be saved? Can that still be called a just war when you take that position? You mentioned, for example, that when the police moved in, the crime got worse. But actually, insofar as there were police, it was the OSCE monitors, and it was when they moved out that the crime grew worse, because we weren't prepared to risk the lives of OSCE monitors. So my question to you would be, absolutely yes, this was a just cause, but can the when you have to fight from 1,500 feet up and at a distance, can you still call it a just intervention?
This is obviously a very key question, Mary. It's true that politicians, everybody knows, are reluctant to risk casualties. You know, everybody remembers the Somalia episode in the United States. Even in the country in which I lived, Belgium, they lost 10 paratroopers in Rwanda and immediately pulled out within a matter of days from a UN peacekeeping operation in Rwanda some years ago. It's obviously the case that if NATO had been losing pilots every day, not only would that put pressure on politicians to rethink, but it would have also conveyed an impression of military incompetence, quite frankly. In fact, I was at a meeting with Milosevic in Belgrade in October 1998, when he actually said that he would be able to shoot down at least 9 NATO aircraft every night. And maybe the fact that he was not able to do that, although he shot down 2, but not 9 every night, did have a bearing on his psychology. I don't think that we would have won, if I can maybe be a bit bit controversial here, but I don't think that we would have won if we'd created a kind of level playing field in terms of, you know, having a high degree of losses of our pilots, simply to show that we weren't being cowards. Generally, no. It's very difficult. Honestly, it's very difficult for politicians in a humanitarian operation to put their troops under unnecessary risks. I mean, you know, if it's World War II, I mean, if it's national survival, then obviously, you know, that happens, we all know. But in a humanitarian operation, there is a sense that, well, you know, this is not about national interest, and therefore, you know, I shouldn't expose my military to unnecessary risks. I visited the bases during the Kosovo crisis. I spent a whole weekend at Aviano, and I spoke to pilots, and I saw their planes come back. I saw the bullet holes in many of the fuselages, and therefore, I don't want you to get the impression that there was no risk. I don't think I would have had the courage to have got in one of those planes to have flown over Kosovo. There was a lot of air defense, a lot of activity, and it's probably miraculous that we didn't lose more planes than we did. Now, but having said that, I do believe that sometimes politicians misread public opinion. There's been some very good study, a good study done by the University of North Carolina in the United States, which I've been looking at, which shows that indeed the public is willing to accept higher degrees of casualties. It's mainly the politicians who believe that the public is not willing to accept any casualties who have this line. There's no evidence that public opinion feels this. If they believe the mission is just, if they believe, you know, that this is not part of a trend of, you know, irresponsible massive losses because of bad leadership or whatever, and if politicians show the nerve, you know, to press on even though inevitably the bad news is hitting the fan. I think it's going to be hard to move away from this, generally, in those circumstances. Now, the other thing about a ground attack is that wasn't a panacea either. I mean, lots of people suggest that, you know, the air campaign was not effective, but the ground operation would have been instantaneously effective. I don't think so. First of all, you know, the Yugoslavs, if they know, are competent militarily. I've always had a healthy respect for them. Tito left them an extremely good concept of territorial defense. which they had been prepared to do, mainly against the Soviets, of course, throughout the 50s and the 60s. And therefore, it would have been a bloody affair, honestly. I mean, you've read some of the problems that the British Army had with its equipment. You've been reading that in the British press, in an unenforced entry with no opposition. So, you know, I'm not saying that it would have been an easy affair. Any of you, and many of you, of course, here from your comments, know Kosovo like the backs of your hand, will know that the Kachanik defile between Macedonia and Kosovo is very rugged, very hilly, very mountainous, and I think NATO would have taken very significant casualties, quite frankly, in doing that. And, of course, it would have taken months to have got this force together, and again, you know, the humanitarian catastrophe would have gone on in the meantime. No, so I honestly don't think we had any good options. I think we had to use probably the least bad, which at the time ended up being the air campaign.
Okay, what I'm going to do now is take three questions, and I really ask you to make them questions and not speeches. So anybody who asks A, who makes a speech, I'll stop and ask you just to ask a question. So I'm going to start with that lady at the back, who's waving a red.
Well, okay. Thanks for that question, because...
Wait, Jamie, I'll take two more.
Yeah. Do you want me to answer immediately?
No, I'll take two more. Okay, I'll take you and you.
Okay,
and one more down here. Oh, you don't want to ask Chris. Okay, you at the back. Okay, I'll let you answer the questions now.
Well, this is proving to be as vigorous as I thought it was going to be. Okay, Rambouillet. I disagree with that on Rambouillet, and I covered these negotiations extremely closely. First of all, if NATO was going to occupy all of Yugoslavia, we would have had to reintroduce conscription in this country, and I can guarantee you we weren't planning to do that. I told you, Let me answer the question.
Wait, let him answer. Let him answer. Let's hear his answer.
Right, okay. Mary, thank you. I'm giving a presentation today. Tomorrow it can be you, and I'll listen to you, I promise. But for the time being, I'm going to answer the question. The fact is that there was no NATO plan to occupy Yugoslavia. This is a total red herring. What we proposed to the Yugoslavs was a status of forces agreement so that NATO forces could transit through Yugoslavia and have coordination of airspace in order to go to Kosovo for a peacekeeping mission. This would have put the NATO role vis-a-vis Serbia on a legal footing. It's called a status of forces agreement, and it would have been in Yugoslavia's interest to have concluded this. This is something which is standard in any peacekeeping operation where clearly you have to have access and so on. I mean, you can't send military transport aircraft over Yugoslavia for a peacekeeping operation without having coordination with civil aviation in the airspace. It's a technical thing. It's not the dark, sinister thing that you're making out to be. Secondly, it's true that Milosevic did have representatives of minorities in the delegation led by Milutinovic, but I don't believe they played any significant role, and I think they were there purely for a symbolic purpose. And thirdly, it's not true that Milosevic had accepted the Rambouillet Agreement. When Milutinovic, after the three-week pause, came back to Paris, he had 45 substantial objections to the accord, which was agreed in the meantime by the Kosovar-Albanian community. It's clear that they had no intention of seeking an agreement. That's okay, my interpretation, but I'm willing to argue it out in detail. NATO war crimes.
Could you please try not to turn this into a shouting match? Thanks.
Yeah, come on.
Let's keep going. I want to hear the rest of Jamie's answers. This is our chance to ask him questions.
Okay, thanks. Do you speak out like this in all of the lectures given by professors here? How the heck do professors ever manage to teach anything?
Okay. Wait a minute.
Hands up those who would like me to answer the question. Well, I think there is probably a slight majority. Hands up those who don't want me to answer the question. No, okay. Sorry.
I'll let you ask a question in a minute.
You believe in democracy? The democratic vote is that an overwhelming majority want me to answer the question. You, sir, are outvoted.
Okay.
Okay. NATO is not above the law. Absolutely not. Indeed, you know, we made a big play that this intervention was to uphold international law. At the moment, several academic experts, mainly from Canada, have given material to the International Criminal Tribunal to investigate NATO. The tribunal is going to do that, fine. It's part of the tribunal's mandate. If people petition, they're going to look at it. I spoke to Carla Del Ponte, the chief prosecutor, who was at NATO headquarters last week. She's given this to a committee to look at. That's her job. And we'll wait and see what her pronouncement is. My personal feeling, and I think many others share this, particularly in the NATO governments, is that she will say that there is absolutely no foundation whatever in international law to prosecute either NATO, the organization, or individuals. But I'm going to leave that verdict up to her. It's for her to make and not me. Secondly, we're not going to discuss every topic in the universe in the next 10 minutes. Secondly, the NATO countries are the countries that in the United Nations push for the establishment of the International Criminal Tribunal in The Hague. We fund it. NATO countries at about 80% of the funding at the moment. Of those indicted war criminals that have so far appeared in The Hague, 32, 18, there was one just the other day, 18, in other words, the majority of those actually in the tribunal have been captured by NATO and transported there, and this rate is accelerating, and we'll continue to do it until all of them are in the tribunal. So on that one, sir, generally, I'm relaxed.
Wait a minute.
Yeah. Okay. I had a third question, a final one, just to close the debate for this evening, which is Somalia. I'm not going to get into that. That's not my topic. No, I'm not. I made my point, which was an illustration of public opinion in the United States. It wasn't about Somalia or internal Somali situation. Milosevic against Hitler, I never used that, not at all. I didn't make that comparison. I called Milosevic many things, that's absolutely true, but not Adolf Hitler. I still believe, no matter how egregious Milosevic is, that there is a big, big difference between him and Hitler, and therefore I never made that comparison. Mary, thanks very much.
Thank you. Oh, okay, I'll say it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Xi and Professor Calder, for being with us today. I think it's been very interesting, and I hope you all enjoyed it. Thank you very much for attending this lecture. Of course, I hope to see you back for future events on which we will keep you updated. Please remain seated for 2 minutes while Mr. Xi is escorted outside of the building. Thank you.
Being escorted into places and out of places remains a hazard of being a NATO official. Thank you very much indeed to everybody at the LSE. Thank you.